Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture by MIT Professor of Linguistics, Noam Chomsky. Tonight's lecture is part of the Boston University Psychology Department Distinguished Lecture Series and the Human Development Program Colloquium Series. Professor Chomsky's lecture is titled Biolinguistic Explorations, Design, Development, and Evolution. We begin with an introduction by Elizabeth Donovan, doctoral student in the Human Development Program in Psychology. Ms. Donovan.
Professor Chomsky is the Institute Professor and Professor of Linguistics, Linguistic Theory, Syntax, Semantics, and Philosophy of Language at MIT. Professor Chomsky is credited with the creation of the theory of generative grammar, the most significant contribution to the field of theoretical linguistics of the 20th century. Chomskyan models have been used as a theoretical basis in several other fields, including computer science, mathematics, and evolutionary psychology. Professor Chomsky is also known worldwide for his political activism. As a result of his wide array of interests, he has published hundreds of articles and books, including over 180 on linguistics. Professor Chomsky has received numerous awards, including honorary degrees from institutions around the world. Additionally, he is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the National Academy of Science. He's also a recipient of the Distinguished Scientific Contribution Award of the American Psychological Association, the Kyoto Prize in Basic Sciences, the Helmholtz Medal, the Dorothy Eldridge Peacemaker Award, the Ben Franklin Medal in Computer and Cognitive Science, as well as others. He is a twice winner of the Orwell Award, granted by the National Council of Teachers of English for distinguished contributions to honesty and clarity in public language. Professor Chomsky's contributions have also been recognized in less traditional ways. For example, between 1980 and 1992, he was the most cited living scholar. And as an additional testament to the magnitude of his broad cultural appeal, Bono of U2 called Chomsky a rebel without a pause, the Elvis of academia. We are delighted to welcome Professor Chomsky as our distinguished speaker. He will be talking today about biolinguistic explorations, design, development, and evolution. Please join me in welcoming Professor Noam Chomsky.
Thanks. Well, let me start with a couple of words about my favorite century, the 17th century. Famous philosopher, historian of philosophy and science, Alfred North Whitehead, once wrote that for the last several centuries we've been living off the accumulated capital of the scientific genius of the 17th century, which is not much of a distortion. It's pretty much true. In the natural sciences, it's very largely true. In our field, psychology, linguistics, philosophy, it's much less true, much to their detriment, I think. There was part of the scientific revolution of the 17th century was a cognitive revolution, which was extremely important and developed many of the ideas that were rediscovered without knowledge of their antecedents. In what's called the cognitive revolution, should be called the second cognitive revolution of the 1950s, which led to cognitive science, linguistics, related areas, philosophy of language and mind in the sense that we know them today. And in fact, much of that work is still unknown and I think underappreciated. So to take simple elementary example. One of the notions that plays a fundamental role in studies of acquisition of language or nature of language is what's called poverty of the stimulus. And there's a huge debate about whether it exists, what is it? Is it some weird thing about language or something like that? In fact, all of this is a total misunderstanding, for which I admit some guilt. I used the term, probably invented the term, talking about language, but it's a general property of all growth, and that's well known and understood outside the studies of the mind, of cognition, where it's supposed to be something special. So it's taken for granted, for example, no one even bothers to mention it, that the growth of an embryo to a mature, whatever it is a striking illustration of extreme poverty of stimulus. The stimulus from the point of view of the embryo is whatever the nutritional and other environment is, and it's perfectly obvious, and no one bothers to talk about it, that the embryo doesn't become a person or a chicken or whatever because of the nutritional environment, which is far too impoverished to yield that consequence. So it's simply taken for granted without discussion that that results from some internal property that the of the embryo, what we would now regard as, in part at least, its genetic endowment plus other factors that enter into morphogenesis, and growth, and so on. It's only in the studies of the mental aspects of the world that that's considered a strange and debatable thesis, as if they are somehow out of the organic world, odd kind of dualism that's characteristic of contemporary thought, and particularly the part of it that regards itself as highly scientific. In the 17th century, this was all quite clear. So the classic study of poverty of stimulus in the cognitive domain was Descartes' discussion of how an infant or an adult perceiving something, no great distinction was made between growth and perception, and they are very similar, how in either case the infant or the adult sees what they do. His simple example that he used was a triangle. So suppose I were to draw a triangle on the board over there. What you would actually do, Descartes argued, these are incidentally thought experiments, like most of the 17th century experiments, Galileo's and others. but if anyone were to carry them out, this is what would happen. You were to look at that thing I drew on the board, your eye would scan it. So there would be a sequence of impressions on your retina, a sequence of stimuli on your retina. But you don't perceive a sequence of stimuli as you sort of scan the figure in some fashion. What you can perceive is a triangle. And in fact, what you perceive is a distorted triangle. If you look carefully, you don't see a perfect example of whatever it is, which obviously isn't going to be a triangle, but you see it as a triangle somewhat distorted, like maybe one of the lines is curved and two of them don't quite come together, or one of them sticks out a little beyond the other, and so on. That's just your immediate perception. Your instantaneous immediate perception is a distorted triangle. It shows the vast extent of poverty of the stimulus. The stimulus on your retina is just a sequence of stimulations. Descartes thought pressures, but we look at it differently, but same thing. And he argued that the same would be true of an infant. So he suggested that when first in infancy an infant is exposed to, say, that figure, the infant will perceive a distorted triangle, not a sequence of stimuli as the retina, as the eye scans it, and not a perfect example of whatever distorted figure it is. As far as I know, no one's ever carried out that experiment, but it would almost certainly work that way. The infant does this because of some internal structure that determines that that's the way you perceive geometrical figures. And Descartes and others went on to argue that that's exactly the same if you look at more complex things, like, say, something that you see as, say, that I see here as people sitting in the room. Actually, what I see is something far more impoverished than that, but I do perceive it as people sitting in the room or men walking down a street or something like that. It's all must come from internal resources. In the case of the triangle, Descartes argued the mind is just constructed so that it generates geometrical figures, pure geometrical figures, and anything else, and it uses those as a kind of a paradigm with which to interpret whatever scattered stimuli actually reach the retina. By now, last couple of decades, there's the beginning of understanding of the neurophysiological mechanisms that that yield these consequences, beginning with the work of Hubel and Wiesel about 45 years ago and others since. But it's still rudimentary understanding, but there's very little doubt that that would happen. Well, that's a dramatic and clear and unexceptionable illustration of poverty of stimulus in the visual domain. The other major domain that was investigated in the first cognitive revolution, much as in the second, the one in the 1950s, was language. Those were the two major topics studied then, and they're the two major topics studied now, some others, but that's the mass of the work, partly because of accessibility of the materials. In the case of language, what was taken for assumed, and sort of, again, thought experiment, but seems obvious, is that the basic elements of language, say concepts or words, if there's any difference between them, those must be primarily generated internally. Their complexity and richness is such that they can't possibly be acquired from experience. They were what were called common notions or innate ideas formed by some internal generative process that's structured in some fashion. And there was a good deal of research into, or at least thought, about how this is done, suggesting that what's involved is gestalt, what are now called gestalt properties, notions of causal relation, notions of agency, anthropomorphic perspectives, all familiar about the way we perceive and think about the natural world. So you see, you talk about a comet as aiming towards the Earth and fortunately missing it, as if it had agency and intention. And the Earth sun rises in the morning. We don't talk about the Earth setting in the morning and so on. And that's true of just about everything we talk about, no matter how simple it is. And the properties of the concepts we use are the same, but they can't be coming from the stimuli of the external world. And in fact, as far as we know, there are differences among, significant differences among organisms in how they perceive the world and what ethologists called their Umwelt, the world of experience that in which they live will be different for different organisms, different for us and for bees, let's say. Not because the stimuli are different, but because they're differently constructed internally. The investigations recognize that there have to be both what were at that time called innate ideas or common notions, fixed universal concepts that are just part of our nature that provide a framework for interpretation, understanding, and so on, but also principles, generative principles of some kind, like the principles that form geometrical figures, which yield the internal symbolic constructions that permit us to express our thoughts using the atomic elements that are given by nature, basic atomic elements. And in fact, the linguistic research of the period did pursue those two lines of inquiry. What's the nature of the concept? What's the nature of the universal principles by which expressions are constructed as modes of expression of thought, sometimes externalized, mostly just in your head when you're talking to yourself. By far the statistically speaking, by far the greatest use of language, as you can determine by introspection. A lot of interesting work was done in both of those domains. I won't try to review it. A lot of it is still far from having been reached in many of its details in contemporary work. That's particularly true of the study of concept, which today is much more impoverished than it was in the 17th, 18th century. It was recognized at that time that our most elementary concepts or words don't pick out identifiable things in the world. They don't pick out mind-independent objects. Actually, that insight goes back to Aristotle. Aristotle's example was a house. He said a house is, in his terminology, a house has both matter and form. The matter of the house is bricks, wood, whatever it's constructed of, and that's mind-independent. The form of the house is its function, its design, the fact that people live in it or store things in it and so on. And the house itself is a combination of matter and form. So it has both material constitution and design and function. And when Aristotle defines the house, he says you define a house as a combination of matter and form. Now, actually, it's important to recognize that the tradition from Aristotle up to the 17th century, and in fact revived in the contemporary period, is to talk about this metaphysically. You're defining a house, not the word house, not the concept house. So he's defining the thing house, one of those things in the world, which, and matter and form were both regarded as part of the world, metaphysical. That approach yields hopeless dilemmas and conundrums. Those of you who've taken philosophy courses will have run into examples of them, like the famous Ship of Theseus, modern examples, Saul Kripke's Puzzles of Belief. You can run through them if you like, but they run these take off on our concept of city or ship and so on, and show that if you regard them as mind-independent, you run into impossible, unsolvable paradoxes. That's taken to be a big problem all the way through from classical philosophy up to the 17th century, and again in the last 40 years. That's regarded as some kind of major puzzle. The 17th century, however, looked at it differently. Now, there was a cognitive revolution, remember, so there's a reinterpretation of the metaphysical approach to an epistemological or cognitive approach. So you're not trying to define house or ship or London or something like that. You're trying to define the concept. And if you discover that the concept doesn't apply in all possible situations, as it doesn't, that's fine. There's no reason why it should. Concepts are not built into us to deal with imaginary situations that we can construct. So yes, they don't apply clearly in all situations. There's no conundrum, no paradox, just the problem of discovering what our conceptual structures are. And that's a very productive and accurate way of looking at it. It's not the standard way today, and it wasn't the standard way prior to the 17th century, but it should be the right way. And if we think about concepts and words a little, becomes pretty obvious that that must be true. The word house is not a bad example. In fact, if you look at it more carefully, defining it in the word house in terms of matter and form is nowhere near sufficient. Our understanding of what a house is far richer than that. So, for example, if I say, I painted my house brown, you understand me to mean that I painted the exterior surface brown. I can tell you that I painted the interior surface brown, but I have to do it in a more complicated way. I have to say I painted my house brown on the inside. Okay, then you know I meant the inside. That's what's called a marked expression. So if I say I climbed the mountain, you interpret me as going, saying I went up, but I can say I climbed down the mountain. Okay, then I went down. House is the same. The exterior surface is kind of unmarked. That's what you take the house to be. You can, with more complexity, identify the interior surface. But a house is not just an exterior surface. It can't be. If it were, it would be a geometrical object. And you couldn't, and if you were, let's say, 5 feet away from the surface on the inside, you would be near the house, but you're not. You're in the house. If you're 5 feet from it on the outside, you're near the house. And it doesn't have anything to do with its being contained. Same's true of, say, a lean-to, which kind of goes like this, or even a straight wall, depending on whether you live on one side or the other. You're near it if you're in the part that's intended to be, if it's outside the part that's intended to be inhabited, you're inside it if you're the other one. So there's a, and you can go on and on like this. Think through, you'll find many more complicated aspects to the notion. And it's true of any notion. A house may be a little bit misleading because it's an artifact, and one might think that artifacts have those special properties. But the same is true of the simplest words that aren't artifacts. So it takes another word that was studied in the 17th century, first by Thomas Hobbes. Take, say, the Charles River, which somewhere around there, I'm not aware exactly. The Charles River we call a river. But if you think about it a little, you can, under very significant changes, dramatic changes, it would still be the same river. On the other hand, under very trivial changes, it wouldn't be a river at all. So, for example, if Hobbes argued that what identifies something as a river is its point of origin, that's part of the truth, but can't be the entire truth, because if the river were, say, if the direction of flow of whatever's in it were reversed, it would still be the Charles River. If it were broken up into tributaries and directed so it ended up in some other place, it would still, under appropriate circumstances, be the Charles River. If whatever minimal amount of H2O is in it were replaced by chemicals from an upstream plant, let's say, it would still be the Charles River, though it wouldn't have any water in it. Probably not much of a change from what it is now, but and so on. Lots of different radical changes would still keep it being the Charles River. On the other hand, trivial changes would keep it from being a river at all. So, for example, if it were directed between two fixed banks, let's say walls, and used for transporting freight, ships with carrying freight, then it would be a canal. It wouldn't be a river. But that's a small change. In fact, if some minuscule physical change were carried out, undetectable except in very sophisticated ways, which was what's called a phase change, just changed its surface so that it became, say, glassy, hard, almost undetectable. I suppose it was changed to become hard, and a line was drawn down the middle of it, and people started using it to commute to Boston. Well, then it would be a highway, not a river, even though the changes are virtually undetectable. And you play with it, you can find many more complexities. What all that means is that a river is not a mind-independent object. It's a mental construct. And the same is true of any other word you look at. One of the terms that raised a lot of interest in the 17th century, mainly because of interest in moral philosophy, was the notion person. So what makes something a person? John Locke, for example, spent a lot of time on this. Well, he argued a person isn't a material object. And without running through the details, he came to the conclusion that a person is individuated in terms of psychic continuity. So if the mind persists and the body changes, it's still the same person. And he concluded, in fact, that if you had two psychic continuities in the same body, it would be two persons. Or if, and in fact, science fiction today plays with notions like that. A single person could inhabit two bodies if it's the same psychic continuity running through it. Again, a science fiction trick. And all of this is known to infants. I mean, I don't know if it's been really studied, but anyone who's had children or grandchildren knows that instantaneously understood. In fact, children's literature is based on these notions from the earliest stages, cross-culturally, as far as we know. So the standard children's story is the handsome prince is turned into a frog by evil witch. Later, the beautiful princess kisses the frog, and out comes the handsome prince, not some other creature. Every child knows it was the prince all along, even if in every physical respect it was a frog, because there was some kind of psychic continuity running through it. My own grandchildren are entranced by a story about a baby donkey named Sylvester who is turned by some process, I don't know what, into a rock and spends the rest of the story trying to convince his parents that he's really their baby donkey, Sylvester. And since children's stories always end happily, something happens at the end and turns back into Sylvester, and everybody lives happily ever after. But the point is that the children have, no matter how young, I mean, since they can understand anything, have no problem understanding, take it for granted, that even if it's in every physical characteristic a rock, it's still Sylvester as long as the psychic continuity persists. Locke was too narrow. This notion doesn't only hold for persons, but for organic creatures and probably for inorganic ones if we look more carefully. And we can proceed. But if you think about it, no matter how simple and elementary the concept you look at, you'll find that those are its characteristics. It's the concepts and words that we have do not pick out entities in the world that, say, a physicist could identify that can be found, by mind external investigation. Rather, they're basically products of the imagination. That doesn't mean that they're not real or that we can't use them to refer and communicate. We can't. So I can use all these terms to communicate to you, and I can refer to them. Referring is an action, not a property of a word. I can refer to them. I can communicate with you. And the reason is that we share a cognitive structure. And if the situation is sufficiently circumscribed so that I can convey to you the perspective from which I'm looking at the world, and you can look at it from the same perspective, then I can use these mental entities to focus your attention on aspects of the world from the same perspective or close enough perspective to mine, and that's a successful act of reference or of communication. So there's no inhibition of communication in these facts, even though there are no mind-independent entities that, say, a physicist could identify to which our words have some relation, a relation of reference or denotation. In technical terms, that means that the concept of the formal concept of reference that you study in logic, that's developed by Frege, Peirce, Tarski, Carnap, and so on, it just doesn't apply to natural language. There is no notion of reference for natural language, as far as we know, or for thought. Human language and thought just don't have a notion of reference. They don't have a semantics in the technical sense. They don't have terms that pick out pieces of the world. This appears to be a respect in which humans differ sharply from any other organism. As far as is known, animal communication systems are based on what's sometimes called a one-to-one relation, an isomorphism between some internal symbol and some identifiable aspect of the world. So if you take, say, calls of a vervet monkey, five calls, looking at the vervet monkey anthropomorphically, the way we look at everything, we say the monkey's giving this call because there's an eagle there and it's telling the rest of the crew of monkeys to run away. Now, what appears to be happening is that there's a reflexive reaction to some, say, motion of leaves or something like that, and then the call comes out. There's apparently an identifiable isomorphic relation between the call and a physically identifiable aspect of the environment, which we interpret and the vervets interpret as meaning get out of the way, you know. Whether they interpret it as a predator's coming or not, nobody knows. We just know that they run away. And that appears to be the case for all animal communication systems, as far as anyone's discovered. If that's the case, then one fundamental difference between humans and the rest of the organic world is that we have concepts that do not pick out mind-independent entities. And that's one of the two major problems that any theory of any account of the evolution of human language and cognition will someday have to face. How did this happen? What change in the human brain led to a completely different way of conceptualizing the world in which we perceive it? Our Umwelt is constructed from internally generated mental objects, which we use to refer and communicate or to express thought or just to have thought, but which do not pick out common mind-independent entities shared by the group that's interacting or the person who's thinking. Well, that's one big problem. Another big problem recognized very well in the 17th century. They weren't talking about evolution, obviously. We do. We don't, can't say anything about it, but we talk about it. The other big problem, which will have to be accounted for, in fact, there are two other big problems that have to be accounted for. One is the fact that our minds are capable of, in fact, constantly do generate an unbounded range of expressions, which in fact express thought. They're related somehow to the mental systems that we have. We have some kind of system of thought, and at some stage in human evolution, some small change took, some rewiring of the brain took place, maybe some small mutation. Nobody knows enough about the structure of the brain to imagine what it could have been, but some small rewiring took place, which provided humans with what's called a recursive operation, an operation that allows them to take the atomic elements that are available, whatever they are, and to construct from them an unbounded array of structured expressions. That operation is there is basically only one such operation that's used to generate any system of it's called digital infinity, like, you know, the number system, integers and language and so on. Now, again, humans appear to be the only organism that has any such capacity. In fact, it's very hard to find in the organic world altogether. It appears to be some kind of special innovation that took place in humans, and that does provide an unbounded range of expressions with which we can then have complex thoughts, sometimes express them, communicate, one of the forms of interaction, and so on. How that happened is the second big problem that has to be dealt with. And there's a third problem, which these first two problems are researchable. You can study them. There's a third problem which you can identify, but nobody knows how to study it. And from the 17th century point of view, it was the major one. That's what is sometimes called the creative aspect of language use. The fact that not only can you construct these expressions, but that you can do so independently of external stimuli and independently of at least identifiable internal states, in a way which is appropriate to situations but not caused by them, which is a crucial difference, and in a way which that it allows you to express thoughts that others like you can interpret and understand and realize that they could have said them the same way if they had thought about them. that combination of properties is, as I say, sometimes called the creative aspect of language use. It's one dramatic illustration of freedom of choice and will, but in a highly structured, complex sense. For Descartes and the Cartesians, that property was the distinctive property that distinguished mind from body, so, and distinguished humans from animals and from automata. The 17th century, much like today, I was fascinated with automata and interested in the question, what makes an automaton or an animal, a beast, so-called, different from a human? And the distinguishing characteristic, primary distinguishing characteristic, was identified as this one. And again, it was argued that you can that this is true of the youngest children, of all human beings, no matter how mentally deformed or whatever, they all have this property that makes them human. Just side word, in the terms of the 17th century, this thesis that this identifies the mind was a scientific thesis, was a normal part of science and a sensible, appropriate part of science. It was assumed at the time that the world is basically a complicated automaton. It's more complex than the kind that skilled artisans were creating, but pretty much the same. In fact, it was believed that the world was created by a skilled artisan, a master artisan. Divinity created this complex machine, and then it just kind of works the way it was designed. So it's like the complicated clock or other complex devices that were at the time being constructed by very skilled artisans and delighted people and so on. So it made a lot of sense to ask, well, what's the difference between a skilled one of those machines and, say, us? Since the Cartesian insight appears to be correct, that a machine can't have this property, then you have to assume that there is some other principle in the world, in addition to the mechanical principle, in their terms, another substance, and that's mind. So you have a dualist approach. Well, we all know, or at least think we know, that that approach collapsed. And in a sense, it did collapse, but not in the way that's commonly believed. What happened is that Isaac Newton, to his great dismay, he never believed it, showed that there aren't any machines. He showed that nothing in the world works by the mechanical principles. That's what action at a distance means. He thought that was a totally absurd conclusion. He said no person with any sense could possibly accept it, but it just appears to be true. And it took centuries before it really settled in. I mean, Newton, to the end of his life, tried to disprove it. Right into the early 20th century, scientists were trying to show that there are mechanical interactions that mean that the world really is a machine, the kind of entity in which I can't move, say, this bottle over here unless I touch it. We now know that that's false, but it is just our only conception of a machine, and it was the conception of the scientific revolution. Well, Newton disproved it, though he didn't believe his disproof, and with the disproof of that assumption, the machine disappeared, but the mind was left intact. So Newton didn't get rid of the ghost in the machine, he got rid of the machine. Now the entire world is ghostly, and you're left with a completely different conception of science. The 17th century conception was that the world should be intelligible to us. Post-Newton, as the Newtonian revolution finally sank in, it came to be realized, as it is today, that the world is just not intelligible to us. That doesn't make sense. And in more modern scientific theories, it just makes no common sense at all, and nobody cares, because you're no longer trying to show that the world is intelligible. It isn't. what you're trying to show is that you can construct theories of the world that are intelligible, which is a completely different enterprise. That's the lowering of the sights of science, and that's what slowly sank in over the centuries. And from this point of view, the study of mental aspects of the world is just like study of chemical or optical or other aspects, just studying various aspects of the world, trying to find intelligible theories of them, try to unify them to the extent that you can. Unification does come about often, but often in extremely surprising ways, even in recent times. You don't know how it's going to come about in the future. Well, that's the nature of the scientific enterprise. Today, it's if you read contemporary literature, you read about the what's called the astonishing idea or the radical new hypothesis, dramatic proposal that the mind is just the a result of the organic structure of the brain. It's got to be true, but it's not part of the structure of the foot, apparently. You can cut your foot off and still have a mind. So it's got to be something about some product of the structure of the brain. But that was just taken for granted by the late 18th century, by the time the Newtonian revolution had set in. In fact, it was stated in this virtually the same words that are called an astonishing hypothesis today. Another example of how we're slowly coming to comprehend what was very well understood centuries ago. Another illustration of the kind of intellectual tragedy of the fact that we haven't been living off the intellectual capital of the 17th century in these domains, in language, philosophy, cognitive science, and so on, and have a long way to go. But the ideas are pretty clear and the understandable, just kind of different than the ordinary way of looking at it. Well, this third property, the creative aspect of language use, remains beyond inquiry. But the second property, the principles that we use to form expressions, to express our thoughts, that's a major topic of investigation. Did pick up again from the 1950s, breaking with the barriers imposed by behaviorist and structuralist dogmatism. They collapsed, fortunately, and we were able to became possible to get back to some of the topics that were seriously investigated centuries earlier, and in fact to go far beyond, because there are new tools, new mathematical tools and others that weren't available then. And that leads to modern linguistics and cognitive science. I don't have time to talk about it, but from then on, you go off into what we understand about the universal principles that enter into what you and I are now doing. Just a final word about it. If it is true, and there's no reason to doubt it, that cognitive capacities, capacity for language and so on, are just aspects of the world, like others, then we would expect that when we study, say, language or moral theory or visual perception or whatever, we would expect to find three separate factors that enter into their growth and development. One factor is what in the 17th century was called innate structure. Today we call it the genetic component. Not knowing a lot more about it than they did. We have a different word for it. So there is some genetic component that determines that we have language, say my granddaughter exposed my granddaughter and her pet kitten or chimpanzee or songbird or whatever may be exposed to precisely the same data, precisely the same. But only my granddaughter interprets some of it as linguistic experience in a very mysterious way. Nobody knows how this is done. But some of the complex environment is picked out as linguistic experience if you have the right genetic endowment. And then out of that comes knowledge of a language in an almost reflexive way. You're not taught it. You don't really learn it. It just kind of grows in your mind the way other aspects of your the organism develop. That's one factor, the genetic component, which interprets part of the data as experience and constructs some intellectual structure in the mind from that experience and then makes it possible for us to use it in the way we're doing now. The second factor is variation in the data. So we happen to be talking some variety of what's called English, but not some variety of what's called Japanese. Well, no genetic differences, but there are some differences in the data which yield those distinctions. Presumably very superficial ones, can't be very much. And in fact, that's I'll come back to that in a second, but that's the second factor. The third factor, which is much harder to study, but it's coming into view in the study of language and the study of biology also, are just general principles of nature, which enter into how organisms grow and develop in every aspect. I mean, we know that in some cases, everyone knows that, say cell division is into spheres, not cubes, but not because there's a gene that tells the cell, you know, become a sphere, not a cube. That's because of physical principles. And no one knows exactly how far that goes, but undoubtedly the just general principles of nature play a major role in determining how an organism gets to its successive states of maturation and development. And the same is true of evolution. There must be fixed principles of nature that just determine the kind of channel within which natural selection can make a few choices. That's the third factor. And the same is true in language. The principles of language is basically a computational system, so you would expect that principles of efficient computation that don't have anything particular to do with language should enter into the way a language grows in the mind of a child, no matter what language it is. And in recent years, it's for the first time become possible to explore these properties of language and get some interesting results about them. Just to finish, these two areas, biology and linguistics, have been developing in pretty much in parallel for the last 40 years or so, and with a good deal of interaction. That's where the phrase biolinguistics comes from. In both cases, say around the 1950s, it was assumed, both in biology and in linguistics, that in biology, that organisms can vary in every imaginable way. So the variation of organisms is so extreme that each one has to be studied as a special case. And if nature sets a certain problem, natural selection will find a way to solve it. Study a major, you know, take a course in general biology, you still read that. Similarly, in linguistics, it was assumed that languages can vary in every imaginable way and that it's a mistake to approach some new language with a preconception of what it must look like because the variation could be arbitrary. Well, both of those ideas are literally incoherent, and they weren't really meant literally because they are incoherent, but that was the kind of the atmosphere. You know, the assumption is, well, variation is so huge that there's nothing much you can say about it. Over the years, both biology and linguistics have been chipping away at those incoherent assumptions with a fair amount of interaction. And by now, it's not exotic in either field to say that there really only is one organism with slight variations in the timing of regulatory mechanisms and so on, which yield gross superficial differences, but from the same deeply conserved elements, some of which go way back to bacteria. Hox genes are a famous case. And similarly, in the case of language, it's no longer extreme to say that there probably is really just one language with minor variations depending on how this or that option is fixed and when in a well-constructed, well-designed system, slight changes are made in several places, the superficial outcome can look very different. If you want to see an explicit working out of this that's both very expert and very accessible, there's a book by a fine linguist, Mark Baker, called Atoms of Language, in which he takes two languages that are about as different as you can possibly imagine on the surface, English and Mohawk. Every possible property looks totally different. And he tries to show, and to a certain extent does show, that if you assume a fixed structure of options that can be picked in the course of acquisition on the basis of simple data, then the two languages turn out to be virtually identical, just with different choices of options. Very much like the way, a butterfly and an elephant turn out to be pretty much the same animal, with just different choices of timing of regulatory circuits and so on. That's the direction in which both fields are going, and probably will converge in that respect. In biology, it's called sometimes the evo-devo revolution, evolution-development revolution. There's some interesting general books on it. In linguistics, it's called the minimalist program, but it's basically the same thing, and has developed an interaction. Well, these are researchable topics. The one that, for the moment at least, no one has any idea how to research is the one that was the crucial one for the 17th century, and that is the creative aspect of language use and the general problems of will and choice, which appear to be, as far as we know, independent of external stimulation, internal control, appropriate but not caused, these other properties. I'll stop there.
You've been listening to a lecture by MIT Professor of Linguistics, Noam Chomsky. Tonight's lecture was part of the Boston University Psychology Department Distinguished Lecture Series and the Human Development Program Colloquium Series. Professor Chomsky's lecture was titled Biolinguistic Explorations, Design, Development, and Evolution. We began with an introduction by Elizabeth Donovan, doctoral student in the Human Development Program in Psychology. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skoll, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Pozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.